workers have been battling this issue for so long. Right now, workers used to process 145 chickens per minute. That led to a long life injuries to workers.
We have five seconds.
So right now the workers are more in danger by this line speed increase, and so as well as the consumers.
We want to thank you for being with us, and of course we will revisit this issue. Magali Lekola, Executive Director of Enseremos, the advocacy group for poultry plant workers. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Working with as few people as possible on site. The majority of our amazing team is working from home, and we thank each and every one of you. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
KBOO supporters, this is Kat Miao, KBOO's board president. Due to the COVID-19 crisis, KBOO has had to cancel our annual spring membership drive. Canceling such an important fundraiser was not an easy choice, but thanks to an anonymous donor, every dollar contributed now through May 31st will be matched up to $20,000. We know that times are tough right now, so we're asking those of you who are able to give to donate today at kboo.fm/give. Financial support from our listeners is what allows community radio to carry out the important role we play in times like these. Give today at our website. Again, that's kboo.fm/give. Thanks for your support and thanks for tuning in.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Governor Kate Brown explains her framework for reopening the state. Inmates in Washington state prisons are scheduled to be released in the coming days to adhere to social distancing rules, and dozens of cases of COVID-19 have been confirmed among minors in custody at migrant housing centers. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 14th, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. As of Tuesday afternoon in Oregon, there have been 1,633 confirmed positive cases of COVID-19, as well as 55 deaths. The Oregon Health Authority announced two new deaths today, an 88-year-old woman from Benton County and a 71-year-old man from Multnomah County. Both had underlying medical conditions. In a letter to workers, the city of Portland said it will furlough some employees and freeze pay raises as the city prepares to face a massive financial shortfall due to the coronavirus pandemic. The city's chief administrative officer, Tom Reinhart, said, quote, "We estimate a reduction of up to $100 million or possibly more in general fund resources for the fiscal year that will begin July 1st. Mayor Ted Wheeler says he has eliminated his own salary for the rest of 2020. In a Tuesday morning press conference, Governor Kate Brown said that her framework for reopening the state has three prerequisites, including slowed virus growth, adequate personal protective equipment, and increased testing. Brown added that she could not give a specific time frame for when the state would begin to ease restrictions. Nationally, as of Tuesday afternoon, at least 597,000 people have tested positive for the virus, while at least 25,000 people have died. Across the globe, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 1.9 million people, and at least 124,000 people have died. Over 36 cases of coronavirus have been confirmed among minors in U.S. custody at a Chicago-area migrant housing center. CBS reported today that at Heartland Alliance Center, a nonprofit operating shelters for unaccompanied migrant children, more than half of the 69 minors housed there have tested positive for COVID-19. Heartland Alliance spokeswoman Maylee Garcia said in a release, quote, "At the first indication of COVID-19 symptoms in our program, we aggressively moved to obtain testing for all, even beyond CDC recommendations." Officials from the group say they are anticipating many more cases to arise in the days ahead. Independent news source ProPublica reported on Monday that 19 minors and two staff members at Heartland Alliance Southside location had tested positive for the virus. David Sinsky, executive director for Heartland Human Care Services, sent emails out over the weekend confirming these cases. He also said that as test results emerge, social distancing measures are to be ramped up, with staff working among infected minors instructed to stay home on paid sick leave. Lawyers and advocates for detained immigrant children say concerns over a shelter outbreak of coronavirus have been motivating measures asking the federal government to speed up release of minors in custody. Immigration and Customs Enforcement has been under fire in recent weeks to release people in custody in order to abide by social distancing guidelines amid the ongoing pandemic. New Jersey Senator Cory Booker and Washington Representative Pramila Jayapal announced legislation to put a halt on immigration enforcement and for immigrants to be removed from detention facilities during the ongoing crisis. Nearly 1,000 inmates in Washington state prisons are scheduled to be released in the next few days in attempts to keep up social distancing and slow the spread of coronavirus behind bars. Governor Jay Inslee announced on Tuesday his intentions to release over 950 inmates, or about 6% of the state's inmate population, to further prevent transmission of the virus. Inslee's decision arrives following a concession from the Washington State Department of Corrections, which has been caught in lawsuits over the safety of incarcerated persons amid the ongoing pandemic. Columbia Legal Services filed a petition in April with the Washington Supreme Court calling for the release of prisoners to prevent further spread of COVID-19. Other critics maintain that even this is not enough to ensure social distancing guidelines are met in state facilities and that inmates are still at great healthcare risks. Critics asked the governor to look at all cases, not just those that are nonviolent or drug offenders, as many have already served the majority of their sentences and should be considered for early release as well. Monroe Correctional Complex confirmed 7 positive test results for coronavirus among inmates, with 161 others remaining in isolation. Statewide, 912 inmates are in quarantine. With the release of inmates looming, other state emergency measures are requiring Washington prisons to ensure staff and inmates wear face coverings, provide no-cost soap bars to inmates, and sterilize N95 face masks for reuse. Washingtonians are showing their support of Asian American businesses during the coronavirus outbreak. A Facebook page to support businesses in Seattle's International District has more than 18,000 members. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story with the Public News Service.
As coronavirus emerged in Washington state, Asian Americans faced xenophobia and racism, and businesses in Seattle's International District began suffering. Some businesses have gone under, and others are in danger of closing. But in March, Sarah Baker and other Seattleites stepped up with a Facebook group called Support the ID, which now has more than 18,000 members, to promote the area's businesses. Baker is on the board of the Japanese American Citizens League and grew up visiting the International District. She says most of the businesses are family and immigrant run.
I've had several folks just respond and say how much they appreciate the support and that the page itself has just really brought them a lot of business, and it's just been really, really helpful to them during this period.
At the end of March, Baker also started a GoFundMe where donations buy meals from the International District and are delivered to frontline healthcare workers. The effort is featured this week in a video from the In This Together series by the group Define American. It's the second in this weekly series. Shauna Sigelko with the group says they were originally working on a series about immigrant communities coming together, but pivoted with the outbreak of COVID-19. She says folks find out what they're made of in crises like this.
It's important to us that we're acknowledging the challenges that the Asian American community is going through right now, but also really highlighting how so many Americans are galvanized to support that community as well and show solidarity with them.
Baker says she's been heartened by all the support for the International District.
To see average everyday people going out of their way to support each other and to support the community, it's definitely been a big highlight for me the last couple of months and has been really keeping me going despite all of the bad stuff that's been happening.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tagadoff.
Many local small business owners are having difficulties applying for and receiving one of the forgivable small business loans that Congress approved last month. The Small Business Administration and the U.S. Treasury have designed the Paycheck Protection Program, or PPP, to help provide small businesses with forgivable loans in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic. The loans that the PPP are meant to provide include 8 weeks' worth of payroll for businesses with fewer than 500 employees. However, business owners have expressed their frustration with the application system as banks are flooded with loan requests. According to Linda Navarro, president of the Oregon Bankers Association, banks have had to work with the program as it was being built and have been working at their full capacity to process the large volume of PPP loan requests. Local farmers are being forced to dump much of their crops because many of their buyers in the food service sector are closed. While there was a surge in produce demand in March with people stockpiling food basics in their pantry, many farmers are now feeling the economic sting of a sagging market and the loss of many large-scale consumers due to closures from COVID-19. Snake River Produce is finishing their packing and shipping season Tuesday, with a staggering amount of produce being thrown out. The Oregon-Idaho-based business will be tossing roughly 2 million tons of onions and other produce, as the demand just isn't there. Tons of unused produce is being dumped at Owyhee Produce, which grows enough onions to feed 7 million Americans for a year. As big customers like schools and restaurants continue to cancel their orders, similar waste can be found nationwide with staples such as milk, green beans, and strawberries. A fraction of the supply is being sold, and vast amounts are being thrown away. Some small-scale local farmers have actually increased business, with some offering pre-orders and free delivery. Farmers markets have also taken a hit, but with many people cooking for themselves, the demand for local, healthy ingredients is keeping the businesses afloat. For those working the land and growing food for us, fingers are crossed things can return to normal before further economic losses are incurred. A Portland man who is accused of robbing three local banks on Valentine's Day has been arrested in Maryland. KBOO's Al Khan has the story.
A 55-year-old man who allegedly robbed three Portland banks within 40 minutes on February 14th is now in custody in Maryland. Portland police and the FBI received anonymous tips from Maryland identifying the robber as John W. Lubow after releasing video footage. In each robbery, Lubow approached the teller, handing them a note which read, "Relax, this is a robbery, and I have a gun." The first occurred at the Bank of the West located at 419 Northwest Broadway at 1:52 p.m. where the teller handed over just a little over $5,400. However, a security guard intervened as Lubow was leaving, and after a brief struggle, the guard took Lubow's backpack, which had the cash inside. Lubow was able to flee on a white bicycle, according to witnesses. The second robbery, located at 2011 West Burnside, happened at 2:17 p.m. Lubow again approached the teller with a note that demanded all their big bills, but the teller was able to only hand over $44. The third robbery occurred only 12 minutes later at the Home Street Bank at 22 Northwest 23rd Avenue. At this location, the robber told the teller to give him everything they had and left with over $1,800 cash. Lubow is now in custody in Maryland awaiting extradition to Oregon. For KBOO News, I'm Al Khan.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Portland City Council candidate Keith Wilson. Then at 6, it's Preference, and at 7, Calculated Conversation. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy in the evening, giving way to a few showers after midnight with a low of 49 degrees. Tomorrow will be partly cloudy with a high of 66. Today in history, in 1865, President Abraham Lincoln is assassinated at Ford's Theater in Washington, D.C. by John Wilkes Booth. The quote of the day is from Abraham Lincoln, who said, quote, I am a firm believer in the people. If given the truth, they can be depended upon to meet any national crisis. The great point is to bring them the real facts. More than 30 people were killed over Easter weekend as a series of tornadoes touched down across the southern United States. KBOO's Al Khan has more.
At least 33 people have been killed, and hundreds of homes and businesses have been destroyed as a series of tornadoes tore a path of devastation across the American South over the past holiday weekend. More than 1 million homes have lost power due to the high winds from the storms, which touched down from Texas to Tennessee. Outages were most severe in North and South Carolina, but every state affected by the storms reported a loss of power. In Georgia, at least 5 people have been confirmed dead by the Maury County Emergency Management Agency. South Carolina has reported 8 fatalities related to the storms, with 5 in Hampton County, which is hardest hit in that state. In all, there were more than 60 reports of tornadoes in the states of Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Kentucky, Tennessee, along with North and South Carolina. Reports of people trapped in their homes continue, as well as people with injuries related to the tornadoes. Over 500,000 people remain without power as crews struggle to restore service. For KBOO News, I'm Al Khan.
A new report has found that throughout the federal government's pandemic response, Jared Kushner's supply chain task force ignored federal guidelines in order to push contracts with his corporate connections. This ended up costing weeks of crucial response time in which the federal government fell behind the rapid increase in demand for protective equipment for medical personnel. According to the report by MSNBC, Kushner and his team pushed aside long-established federal emergency management response teams, favored some of the nation's largest corporations, and ignored small producers of goods and services with track records of meeting emergency needs. Governors, local officials, and veterans of federal emergency response have said that Kushner's team complicated the national fight against the pandemic. They say this is yet another example of Trump's task force serving industry as the White House tried to corner the market on medical supplies. As the nation marches towards the 2020 presidential election, Oregon Senator Ron Wyden is pushing to make vote-by-mail a national norm. As the first U.S. senator to be elected in an entirely vote-by-mail election in 1996, Wyden is the head sponsor of a bill that would require all states to allow mail-in ballots during the pandemic. The bill is also sponsored by Senators Amy Klobuchar and Chris Coons and would disperse roughly $2 billion to help fund states not accustomed to vote-by-mail systems. Currently, 34 states and Washington, D.C. have vote-by-mail elections and allow anyone to vote by mail if an absentee ballot is requested. Funds made available would provide prepaid ballot envelopes and high-speed scanners able to process absentee ballots quickly, as well as other transitional costs for states not currently offering mail-in elections. Amid health concerns facing the novel coronavirus crisis, mail-in voting is just common sense, according to Wyden. Though current data suggests vote-by-mail could improve voter turnout, partisan opposition is still facing the proposed bill. With President Trump saying mail-in voting increases the risk of voter fraud, Wyden told the Portland Mercury on Monday, quote, "National Republicans like Trump or Senator Mitch McConnell are increasingly out of step with local Republicans." Wyden also maintained that mail-in voting does not favor Democrats and that many local Republican lawmakers are on board with the transition. When asked who favors the option of voting by mail, Wyden's response was everybody, ranging from conservative rural voters to young urban voters facing hectic schedules to communities of color who have faced intimidation in traditional elections of the past. As COVID-19 fears loom in the face of the approaching election, advocates of the bill are calling it a step towards safeguarding our elections and the democratic participation of all eligible voters without compromising voters' health and safety. After sitting on the sidelines, former President Barack Obama entered the 2020 fray on Tuesday, endorsing his former Vice President Joe Biden to challenge President Trump in November. In a video released Tuesday morning, Obama said of Biden, quote, "I believe Joe has all the qualities we need in a president right now. Joe gets stuff done." The former president went on, calling for a great awakening against the politics of Trumpism, citing the Republicans occupying the White House as only interested in power, not progress. He also cited Biden's management of the 2009 H1N1 swine flu outbreak, and his work after the 2008 recession as reasons Americans should trust his guidance amid the ongoing coronavirus pandemic. Obama praised Senator Bernie Sanders for setting a new agenda for the Democratic Party and expressed hope further progressive ideals would be reflected through Biden's campaign moving forward. Sanders, who suspended his presidential bid last week, offered his endorsement of Biden on Monday. Spokespeople from the Trump administration lambasted Obama's endorsement, saying he was left with no other choice and citing instances where Obama allegedly urged Biden not to launch a White House bid. Democrats are hoping that Obama's endorsement will help unify the party in what looks to be a rough-and-tumble presidential contest with Trump. The Democratic National Convention has now been postponed to August, with questions remaining how traditional politics will play out amid coronavirus and social distancing. Montana tribes are updating residents about COVID-19 cases on the reservation. The Gila River Indian community has obtained a rapid testing machine, and New Mexico senators are urging FEMA to provide tribes prompt coronavirus aid. With those stories and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Leaders of the Crow and Fort Peck tribes in Montana are updating residents about COVID-19 cases on their reservation. Nikki Ouellette has more.
Crow Tribal Chairman A.J. Not Afraid confirmed the Crow Nation's first COVID-19 case last Thursday. Not Afraid says the local Indian Health Service alerted the tribe's incident command. The patient is in isolation, and public health nurses are monitoring people who recently came in close contact. Last Wednesday, the Fort Peck Tribe's COVID-19 task force announced two employees at Riverside Family Clinic, which is located within the tribe's reservation boundaries, had contracted the illness. Chairman Floyd Azure had previously warned tribal members that spreading false information could be prosecuted with a $500 fine and possible jail time. Montana's health department says 13 of the state's nearly 400 confirmed COVID-19 cases are American Indian. That's roughly 3%. Most tribal executives in Montana are requiring reservation residents to self-quarantine after traveling off-reservation. Some have set up checkpoints at reservation entry points and have issued evening curfews in an effort to slow the spread of the virus. Crow tribal executives are urging people to shop locally and avoid cities like Billings, Montana, and Sheridan, Wyoming. For National Native News, I'm Nikki Ouellette.
The Gila River Indian community in Arizona has obtained a rapid Abbott analyzer unit to address COVID-19 testing. Test results from the analyzer are expected to be ready within minutes and will be conducted on the reservation instead of waiting days to learn of test results. Governor Stephen Ray Lewis says it arrived this week after working with the Indian Health Service and the White House to obtain the technology. The governor says the analyzer is a potential game changer for the community to help with COVID-19 response efforts. In a video message to tribal citizens, Governor Lewis encourages people to continue to follow measures already in place.
And you must all continue to do your part by sheltering in place, avoiding unnecessary travel outside your home, washing your hands frequently, and social distancing. Until we have our testing in place, our social distancing measures are our most effective measures for protecting our community, our elders, our most vulnerable, and ourselves. As you all know, there is no vaccine at this time, so the only vaccine is your behavior, to continue your social distancing until there is a vaccine developed.
As of Monday, there were 23 positive cases of COVID-19 on the Gila River Indian community. Navajo police issued more than 115 citations during a 57-hour weekend curfew. The Navajo Nation issued the curfew order in an effort to slow the spread of COVID-19. The Navajo Police Department, with 7 police districts and more than 120 officers, implemented the curfew operation over the weekend across Navajo land. A nightly curfew remains in place, which officers say they'll continue to enforce. Due to the Easter holiday, the tribe did not report new cases of COVID-19. As of Monday, positive tests for COVID-19 reached 813 for the Navajo Nation, with 28 deaths related to the coronavirus. New Mexico U.S. Senators Tom Udall and Martin Heinrich say they're urging the Federal Emergency Management Agency to take prompt action on tribal requests for COVID-19 funding. The senators sent a letter to FEMA officials outlining concerns about impacts COVID-19 is having on tribes in New Mexico, including taking economic hits by the closure of tribal businesses. Federal appropriations have been set aside for tribes to respond to COVID-19. FEMA is the lead agency coordinating federal response. The letter from the senators asks that all tribes in New Mexico, regardless of whether they have an independent declaration or fall under the state of New Mexico's declaration, receive 100% federal cost share. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A new report says that lessons are still to be learned from BP's Deepwater Horizon oil spill that permanently damaged wetlands and continues to affect marine mammal populations. Suzanne Potter has more on the story with the Public News Service.
A report out today from Oceana says the feds have failed to learn from the biggest oil spill in American history, the BP Deepwater Horizon disaster, which took place 10 years ago next week. The Trump administration is working to expand offshore drilling, even proposing new wells off the California coast. Diane Hoskins is campaign director at Oceana and co-author of the report. She says it's not a question of if there will be another large spill, but when.
Offshore drilling is still as dirty and dangerous as it was 10 years ago. And if anything, another disaster is more likely today as the industry drills deeper and farther offshore in much riskier places.
The administration's draft 5-year offshore energy plan would open up nearly all federal waters to new drilling. Last month, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management confirmed it is still working to update the proposed 5-year plan, which has been held up by a lawsuit challenging the government's right to lift Obama-era protections for sensitive areas in the Atlantic and Arctic oceans. The feds already have rolled back some of the regulations put in place after the disaster, rules Hoskins says are crucial to prevent another blowout.
For example, reducing the frequency and duration of testing for safety equipment, weakening onshore monitoring of a particular safety equipment, and removing a requirement for an independent third party to review safety plans.
Oceana is calling on the President and Congress to halt all new offshore drilling projects in federal waters and invest more in renewable energy. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 14th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at our new number, 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Al Kahn, Jenka Soderberg, and Jeffrey Wade. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Lily Bolke, Eric Tegadoff, and Suzanne Potter. The director of evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio featuring news and commentary on local, national, and international issues. At 10, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, The Food Show keeps you up to date on the news and issues surrounding the food on your plate. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by listener support. If you would like to support us, go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth. We'll be right back.
KABU News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Today on KABU News In Depth, we are continuing our coverage of the race for Portland City Commissioner Position 4. We are speaking with Keith Wilson, a second-generation Portlander and businessman, challenging Commissioner Chloe Udaly for her seat.
Okay, so my first question, I want to know what inspired you to make a run for city council?
I have been a Portlander all my life, and I had the good fortune of, once I finished college, to move back east, and then afterwards I was able to work around the world, and being from Portland, I was able to compare the city to all the other great cities, or many of the great cities in the world, and you can easily see why Portland is so nice. You can easily see why people move here. And frankly, my community, my family, the outdoors, and the city is beautiful. And so I found my way back here. And then I've been working in a transportation company for the most of that time. And really, in this last 10 years since the last recession, I've seen the city struggle to gain its footing versus where it was. And granted, everything changes over time, but we've struggled with homelessness, our inability to keep our city cleaned and maintained, and I wanted to jump in and tackle some of those key items. Our safety issues with our Vision Zero and the fatalities ever increasing, those are areas that I know a lot about, and I want to give back. It's time to give back to the city and to my family and to the people that I love. And so I chose to run for council, and I wanna do what I can to really give back as far as public service.
Yeah, and so you mentioned, you know, you have some experience in business. How do you think that will apply to the city commission?
Very well. I have experience running a complex organization. I have a transportation company, so I grew it from a one facility operation here in Portland, and it's a family business, and so I had the good fortune to work with my father for a long while. Since taking over the company, I gained a master's degree, and I focused it on transportation. I gained it from the University of Portland, and then I expanded the company throughout the Northwest, and it's focused on transportation. I'm actually running for position number 4, and that's Chloe Udaly's seat. She's the current commissioner of the Portland Bureau of Transportation, and that's in my wheelhouse. So I'm very much a climate-focused person as far as the climate emergency. I have one of the greenest companies, and I want to apply that to Portland. I'm a Vision Zero expert, so I have one of the safest companies in the world, and you could argue that, but we haven't had an accident in 5 years where somebody was hurt, and we didn't even have any accidents in this last 18 months, so it's one of the best records. And I understand trucking, transportation, equipment, and key performance indicators. So my business is and runs at a very high level. It's I would like to say it's a fine-tuned machine. So that's my expertise. I am a businessman, but in the same respect, I'm very conscientious about the environment. And I think if we bring those two things together, running an organization like PBOT, 500 million, it would be nice. I think having somebody with that experience can really make that department very strong, and I think we can compete against any department across the nation, but more importantly, I think we can be the greenest department in the nation. So I want to have that opportunity.
Yeah, and so let's speak to your transportation expertise. Thinking about Portland, what do we do well for transportation, and where is, you know, the biggest route and place we need to improve?
One of the things we do well, and this is really getting into the weeds, Althea, we maintain our roads through our city, so we don't outsource. So one of the things we have the ability to do with our paving is there's a brand new paving process. It's called Green Streets, or I call it Green Streets. So I've been working with an inventor in LA. It recycles asphalt in place, so you don't have to bring in new hot melt asphalt, and you don't have to remove the old road. It just recycles the road in place. So because we do all of our maintenance, or the vast majority, in-house, we have a lot more control over newer techniques, which puts us in a huge opportunity, because when you do these new techniques, they can be greener than they've ever been. So it's a 90% less carbon footprint if we were to do the asphalt pavement that way. And we can really improve our roads and maintain them at a lot lower cost. Now, I know you said, what do we do well? That's something we can do better or do well because we have it in-house. And then I believe your question was, and then what can we do better? Was that correct?
Yeah.
So our safety system, we spent $100 million in this last 5 years on road quieting, on speed reduction through our maintenance program. It's $100 million. And that's all been in the spirit of addressing our Vision Zero. But over that 5 years, we've gone from 28 fatalities to 49 last year. So you can see, seems like the more we spend towards our Vision Zero through PBOT, the more fatalities we have. We're not tackling it appropriately. It's distracted driving. At my business, I've been able to experience that same increase in accidents or incidents. When we hit a bollard or we hit an awning, it's always a distracted driver incident, or a tree, if you will. We've addressed it by adding artificial intelligence. It's cutting edge, it's high tech, and since we've done that, we've had zero accidents. So we're one of the leaders in the world with this technology, and I want to apply that to Portland to reduce accidents and fatalities. And so as an expert in that field, that's something I can bring to Portland that really would help tremendously. I had Amazon visit 8 weeks ago. They had 30,000 trucks they want to add it to, and I had Department of Transportation, the ODOT Department of Transportation, visit 4 weeks ago to see what leadership position we have. And I think it would be, I know I can focus on Vision Zero and help Portland reduce fatalities.
So let's switch gears here. Obviously, affordable housing and houselessness are some of the most challenging issues that Portland is facing today. How would you approach those problems from the City Council?
All right. Since 1997, we've reduced our public housing. So this is a federal part of Portland. We've reduced our public housing 66% here in Portland. And public housing is primarily for people with low income. In addition, during that period of time, we've taken our deeply affordable housing, so our SRO units, micro units, and in a lot of cases, they've gentrified into condos and such. So you're actually taking extremely low cost or deeply affordable housing, and you're converting it to high cost. Now, with those two things added together, we're at our current crisis where we just simply don't have enough deeply affordable housing. So that's one of the areas I want to tackle. I had the good fortune of living in New York, and I lived in a single-room occupancy or a micro unit, and I know how well they work, and that's where you share a bathroom and a kitchen, but it's extremely low cost. Althea, a studio in Portland, so one of our lowest-cost housing units is a studio. Our average in Portland is $1,168. It is so hard for somebody who just graduated high school or somebody living on limited income, Social Security, or disability to afford $1,168. That isn't even, that's more than those benefits often are. So we have to really get that in half, and we can do that through focusing our development on single room occupancies and micro units where it's about $500. So you can see we actually have a shot at not subsidizing that, and somebody could actually live and work in the city that they built. If it's somebody retired or a young person, if they're growing up, they can stay in Portland and live in Portland. So that's the affordable housing. The houselessness or homelessness is our city's not managing that at all. We've normalized camping on our streets. And by normalizing camping, pulling the police back and our justice and fire and homeless services, we've seen a 22% increase in homelessness because we're just not cleaning up camps. We're not working with the homeless to provide them a location. And it's even worse than that. We have 80 fatalities on the street last year. So we think we're being compassionate by allowing camping, but it's completely the opposite, because the average age of somebody living on the street is 47 years old. Their life expectancy is 47 years old versus ours is 77. So we have to provide basic shelter, and I propose we use community centers or car park garages that are tied to a shower or a bathroom. So we just converted Mount Scott, a community center, over to a homeless shelter, and that's exactly what I propose as far as a pop-up shelter. So we convert the community center from 9 p.m. to 6 a.m. to a temp homeless shelter, to where somebody can come in and get a good night's sleep safe without being attacked or their gear stolen. They can get up and go to work. They can use the showers and such, but they're not sleeping on the street. We have a moral obligation to discount and discontinue allowing sleeping and camping on the street. Forgive me, not sleeping, but camping on the street, which really affects the quality of life for the homed and the homeless. And I think that's really those two answers. I know I'm going on, Althea, but it's a very important aspect for us to address as a city, and that's one of the main reasons I'm running for council, is to really address those issues.
You know, I'm curious about what your take is on neighborhood associations. Obviously, the way Portland City Administration is set up, it depends a lot on neighborhood associations to bring more regional issues to the attention of city government. And in the past year, Commissioner Chloe Daly attempted to reduce their role, citing equity issues with who's actually able to participate in the neighborhood associations. How, if at all, would your approach to neighborhood associations differ?
I think if we look at it, let's look at the neighborhood associations as a whole. They've been fantastic. This past 40 years, they've come up with some of the most important achievements in the city. Our urban growth boundary, our keeping our limits on the city, which has increased density, which has reduced our need to really add a bunch of roads, which has really helped contain the sprawl that we've got. We've got to look at the benefits. The Clean Start program, that is one of the hallmark successes this last 4 years that the city uses, where we use homeless individuals and we help them bridge from homeless to housed, and then we give them a job through Clean Start. That actually started through the Neighborhood Association. Our neighborhood emergency teams are really a program through the neighborhoods. It is an extraordinary group of men and women that volunteer, that help our city. I think what Commissioner Udaly wanted to do was add more groups to that to make it stronger, and I agree with that, and we should, and it has to be updated. The way she went about it was she discounted views. She did not go out to the market and ask for advice. I believe she made more of a unilateral decision on the way she wanted it to be. But if you don't go out and talk to people and listen before you make the decision, you're not going to make a good decision. So I think it was more a reflection on a poor management technique than the overall program as a whole. Do we need to upgrade and update neighborhood associations? You bet. Should we add civic and community groups? Absolutely. The more support we have in Portland for one another, the absolute more the stronger our community is. As you can see, what happened is because of the management technique, the way the decision was made, it's been put on the shelf. It'll come back and it'll be made stronger, I'm sure of it. But that just, I think, spoke more of the inability or lack of management or how to galvanize decisions. I think it's more a reflection on Commissioner than it is on the plan that was put forward. And this is one of the reasons I'm running as well, is that as far as management and collaborating and coming up with a design, a policy, and then managing that policy, that's my strength.
Thank you for that. Do you have any closing thoughts before we wrap up?
Yeah, just all my best to you and yours. It has been a crazy last few weeks with the coronavirus, with businesses. I've been helping friends as much as I can, been learning as much as I can, and really trying to help the city understand the SBA loans and such. And so just really want to help wherever I can. Also, I would ask that to gain more knowledge about the platform items that I've spoke about, please go to keithforportland.com, and you can really gain a lot more information from that standpoint, or a lot about me and my run for Portland City Council. And thank you, Althea, to you and Kebu for this opportunity. I really appreciate the voice.
We've been speaking with Keith Wilson, a candidate for Portland City Council Position 4. More information on Keith and his campaign can be found at keithforportland.com. The primary election will be held on May 19th. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
We are all in this together. I am talking to actress, comedian, and Portland icon, Wendy Westerwelle. Welcome.
Thanks, honey.
Wendy, I'm wondering if you could tell me how you are spending your days at home. That's not a place that you usually hang out, I'm guessing.
Well, you know, excuse me, home has always been important to me. And I was actually, I'm a little Jewish girl from Chicago, and I love my home. It's a darling little place, and I spent years and years collecting things, and my husband painted everything, hand-painted the entire inside of my house, and it's all hand-painted and beautiful. But you're right. I work at Adorn, I work as a stylist, and I love it, and I work on stage and I do comedy, so I'm very busy and I'm super social and I love being out. And you know, I visit with dear friends and with my friend Darcel. I visit him every week. And but so it's weird being home all the time, but I realize what I've not done, so I'm doing it.
Mm-hmm.
I wake
Have
up
you
in the
Have you found any ways to cope with you know, the fact that you were mostly with other people and now you're spending a lot of time?
Well, I spend a huge amount of time on phone calls. People call me. I visit my neighbors from far, far away. I do Zoom calls. I do lots of texting. And people come and visit me. These two lovely men come and visit me, and they are precious, and they bring me groceries, and they put them up on my porch, and when I visit with them, they drink champagne, I drink Diet Coke, and we stay really far away from each other. So I do it, you know, the Wendy Westerwelle way, but I'm not taking any chances. I'm not doing anything stupid, but I've been in the house since the 14th of March.
That's a long time.
Yeah, along with everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
it's. I wrote to someone. I have a friend in Israel, and they're under quarantine now, and it's very bad there. And I said, you know, I may never see you again. Life as we know it will never be the same. And that doesn't sound like doomsday, but it's true. How do you go through something like this as a people? How do you go through something like this and not come out differently or be the same after this, you know?
Kind of things do you think won't be the same after this?
Well, I think we're going to get rid of the bastard in the White House. Mm-hmm. At least I pray to God that's true. I've been around 72 years, and in all my life, including Nixon and Reagan and Bush, have I ever seen anyone as evil as him? And so I'm hoping to God that President Biden can at least spread the love. I don't think we have to agree with everything. I think we just have to come together. So that'll change. I've never cared about money. So the people that care only about money, I don't know if it'll change them or not. I hope so, but they that seems to be their God. For me, I believe in in a higher power, and I believe that there's some sort of divine thing going on. I don't know. I can't imagine what it could possibly be, though. I just don't know. And I just want people to treasure each other more. My whole life has been about treasuring people and friendship and loving. It really has. Mm. I mean, even though, you know, I came from a neurotic Jewish family, even though I loved them, they were completely insane. And, you know, good resentment and a cup of coffee propelled them through the day. And I, you know, and I grew up anxious and scared. But it's changed, you know. I was married to a man who was extremely, astoundingly spiritual and loving. And he put it all inside me, and I've become a lot more that way. And I have for years. I think that, you know, the only thing, I just swear to you, the only thing that matters is love. Now, I'm not Pollyanna, and I don't think that, you know, oh, you can live on love. I have a beautiful little house that is paid for, thank you, God. But I bought it when I was, you know, 27 years old for $24,000 when my first husband died and left me money. So I'm lucky. I have a roof over my head and I'm warm. And that's a huge deal. But beyond that, it's just about love. Mm-hmm. I swear it is.
You also are a comedian. Is it also about
I still am, but I'm not being very funny today. Okay, well, I'll do one funny thing for you.
Okay,
you know, my people are having Pesach. We're having Passover soon. And I said, oh, my God, this is the big plague, you know. And we're always worried about, you know, locusts and boils. Now we have coronavirus. And I said, we could still have Passover and we'll have a Seder. And instead of blood on the doors, we'll put ketchup, but we'll put it up high so the dogs don't get it. And we're gonna have we'll have our own plague, and we can talk all about it. We don't have to hate anybody or resent anybody. We can just have Pesach. I'm doing a lot of comedy writing during all this. I know I sound very
So you know, a lot of times when people think of, you know, a situation like this, it's really hard to find the humor in it. And also people are also looking for the opportunity to laugh, right?
Exactly. Well, I did some porch talks. My friend Ann Adrian, who's the executive director of Vital Life, who I work for every year, I do fundraisers for them at Revolution Hall. And she came on one of the first days and recorded me on my porch, and she asked me all these questions, and we recorded them. And the truth is, Suzanne, I'm not trying to be funny. I just am funny. It's my heritage. It's where I come from. And I don't, you know, to me, a comedian, you know, that goes up there with all this stuff that they talk about, that's not what I do. I'm not one of those kinds of comedians. I just talk about my life. I talk about Friday night dinner with my crazy family and my rich Uncle Julie, who brought pastries and told me not to eat it because I was fat. And my Aunt Ruthie, who was the original anorexic, who kept telling me she could put a pea in her clavicle. And my cousin Gail, who ran around like the mouse on our Friday night recitals. I mean, I can talk to you about any subject. Just not try to be funny, but it's in me. Mm-hmm. My people are funny, you know. The Jews, we are very funny people.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a great sense of humor, and we've survived and survived and survived, you know.
Do you think there's a connection between surviving and surviving and developing a good sense of humor?
Oh, God, yes. And also not only that, but also forgiveness. You know, I think that, you know, forgiveness is so amazing. And I, you know, I always say, I'll forgive, but that doesn't mean I okay it or I approve it. But I'll forgive. The only one I'm not going to forgive is Trump, because he ruined our country. So I'm not going to forgive him. But I don't actively hate him because it just makes me miserable. So I don't do that. But there's some people, you know, that you just don't, you can't. And I'm a human. You know, Suzanne, you know, I have a saying. I say I have HBP, which is high bitch potential. So there's always a little of that, you know, a little of that edge left in me. I'm sorry, that's my crazy dog.
You know, looking at what's happened so far, besides, you know, a change of government, do you see anything else that's going to be good coming out of this situation?
Well, I think that, I think that the earth is repairing. I mean, I walk outside, I've never heard so many birds in my life. The air is just clean as a whistle. I heard that dolphins are, you know, swimming around Venice. I know that it's just miraculous how the air and the planet is getting a little, Mother Earth is getting a little time to breathe. That's one. And you know what else, Suzanne? I'll tell you something. This is very interesting. The people who are complete, can I swear on this?
No, because okay. It's okay, public radio. Anyway,
no, I won't. So the people that are poop heads will stay that way. Everyone during this crisis shows their true colors. Everyone. The people that are hoarding, the morons that were swimming all together, the kids, all that shows that they, who they are. But the good guys, they are doing a great job. They're the ones, they're the ones who are coming up and doing the best for the world, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everybody that I know and I love, no one's disappointing. People are delivering food, people are making masks, people are sending loving messages. All the performers and all the arts are sending music and dance. And I think that I just pray to God that that stays the same and that people are really going to be together because that's all that matters, really, isn't it? I mean, we all die in the end, don't we? There's nowhere to go.
Mm-hmm.
Your money doesn't help you after you go. You know, so one day at a time is how I live my life. I'm a 12-step girl, and I live one day at a time, and that's saving me. I just wanted to say bless everyone's hearts, and I just hope for the best, and I really, really, really want to stress that people should not be scared, because it is what it is. Just try to get through this with kindness and a brain in your head and be decent. Be a decent human being. That's all you can be. That's all.
I've been talking today with Wendy Westerwell, who is an actress, comedian, and Portland icon. I am Suzanne LeGrand, and this is We Are All In This Together for KBOO Community Radio News, KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Thank you.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM and KBOO.FM online.